Good morning. Welcome to Sunday Morning, a news and public affairs programming service on Cox Media Group. I'm your host, Mimi Lawson. Tim Rummage is with me from Sarasota. What do you do down there?
I am the coordinator of environmental studies at the Ringling College of Art and Design in Sarasota, and I am also the co-author and co-founder of The Spaceship Earth with David Houle, which is a not-for-profit organization here in Sarasota.
I was going to say, kind of sounds like something science fiction.
Well,
doesn't it?
Well, it does, but it's part of it's the Buckminster Fuller title of Spaceship Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then the feeling was that what we really need to talk about is where we are now. So we went with this Spaceship Earth.
Well, yeah. It's a great name. I loved it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You want to acknowledge any community that commits to increasing citizens' awareness of the Earth.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
That's your mission statement.
In practice, not just say it, but actually is doing it.
So what do you do when you recognize these communities?
Well, part of what, for example, with Sarasota, which is our first one, we went out and we have been talking to the staff in Sarasota. We've met with the town manager. I've been in Sarasota for 25 years, mm-hmm. Working on environmental issues, so I know what the city has been doing for a long period of time.
Right.
And so I know these aren't just words, these are actually actions that they're taking. And what we wanted to be able to do was to sort of validate, have a third party come in like us and say, yes, you are not just saying these things, you are actually doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
And if people want, we can show where this is being done and how this is being done. And give you some public recognition,
mm-hmm.
And also in some cases, help you promote some ideas or build some allegiances in an area or in part of the community that may not yet be ready to embrace some of the concepts that you're working with.
I've had a go ahead.
Sorry.
You go.
No, I would say when you come in sort of a neutral third party to help with the conversation.
I had a great opportunity to talk to the city manager, Tom Barwin, recently about this Cross Bayou thing that they were doing. And I was really thrilled to see the respect that they're showing to the environment and the concern that they really seem to genuinely have.
They do. The Sarasota has a tourist-based economy in many ways. And so we understand just how valuable the environment is to the whole economics of the community, as well as the beauty of it, and why anybody wants to either come and live here or come and visit here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to make sure that as we grow and improve the economy, that we don't do it at the sacrifice of the either the beauty of the environment or the ecological services that the environment provides us.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. When I first moved here about 30 years ago, I lived in Sarasota down at the Meadows, and
okay.
It was still kind of a little town at the time. In fact, people were teasing me about it. Oh, they roll up the sidewalks at 10 o'clock. Things have certainly changed in those 30 years, but I'm glad to see it hasn't lost that kind of hometowny feel.
No, it hasn't. And so it's, in some ways, it's an easy community to work with because
mm-hmm.
you do have many long-term residents who sort of share some of these common values and have a heritage and history of the place. And so that's very helpful, but you also have a constant set of new individuals coming in.
Right.
Who need to be
educated,
informed about where they are and why this isn't the same as any city you want to name, Dayton, Ohio, Louisville,
right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I also read that the state of Florida is the most at risk when it comes to climate change. Is that part of the reason why we've gone into these communities? Why are we at risk? I mean, I guess it sounds pretty obvious, but kind of give us the down low on what the change in the climate.
Well, what's happening with change in climate is we have been, as humanity at a planetary level, we have been releasing a tremendous amount of greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
This year alone, we will probably release some 37 billion tons of carbon dioxide alone into the atmosphere.
Is that just the United States or is that all over the world?
That's all over the world.
Okay.
That's all over the world. But that's that's a big number. That's separate.
Huge. That's why I asked.
Right. After that's around. I like to translate this in terms of African elephants, 4-ton African elephants. Functionally, we're shooting the equivalent of 300 African elephants into the air every second.
Holy cow. Every second.
Every second. That's how much carbon dioxide we're putting in the atmosphere.
Wow.
And I think that if people could see 300 elephants being launched in the air every second.
Right.
Or hundreds of elephants floating over your head.
Mm-hmm.
That would actually allow us to have more in-depth conversations about greenhouse gases. But since these things are outside of our perception, they're
right.
You know, invisible, odorless, tasteless, you know, it's a tough conversation to have at first.
Especially when you've got people in the administration saying it doesn't exist, that climate change is not happening.
Right. Or that it's a hoax created by another country to, you know,
the same people that made up the Holocaust.
Right. Yes.
Never happened.
Mm-hmm. All of these lead to sort of, you know, what is the science saying, mm-hmm. and how are things changing? And the numbers for sea level rise have been changing relatively dramatically in the last few years. And that's also one of the things that leads to a certain amount of confusion. In our area, in the last 100 years, sea level has risen, according to tide gauges, about 8 inches.
Which doesn't seem like a lot.
That's not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's over 100 years, it's really not very much at all.
Mm-hmm.
But now, with the increased rate of melting ice of the Greenland glaciers, we're looking at almost a 6-inch sea level rise by as early as 2030.
Wow. Doubling. More than doubling our rate.
More than double. So in 15, 16 years, we're going to do what it took us like 100 years.
Right.
To do.
Exactly.
And then if we want to go out to say 2040, 2050, there are real concerns because we are now melting glaciers in Antarctica at an increasing rate.
Right.
And that's what led to some of the projections of an additional 6 feet of sea level rise by 2100.
Wow.
Or looking at, you know, 2040, 2050, just as much as, you know, 2 to 3 feet. So trying to get people to understand that looking at what has happened in the past is no longer a valid view as to how fast things are going to change in the future.
Exactly. And I think some people do think that it's going to change at the same rate. But like you mentioned, the melting of the ice caps, plus we are continuing to put more and more and more at an increasing rate of pollution into the system.
Right. And so the volume is changing and the rate of the volume is changing. And those things combined really put us in a potential jam.
So when you're analyzing the city infrastructure, how are you looking at? Are you looking at just sea level rising? Is that obviously the main thing because we're a sea community?
That's going to be a huge driver, but we recently did a project. We did the Rise and Run, and then we did the Bird's Eye View.
Mm-hmm.
The Rise and Run, we went out and we staked part of Lido Beach with where the tide was now 2017, and then showed with given the gentle rise and flatness of the beaches, if I raise the water 6 inches, how far inland does that water run? And that was really quite shocking for a lot of people at the beach to see just how far that water went in, because In the conversation about sea level rise, we talk about rise. It's going to get higher. But we really don't talk that much about it's also going to move horizontally.
I didn't think
about
that.
People just sort of have the idea, okay, so almost like the water's going to be where it is. It's just going to be taller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. It is going to be taller, but it's going to move inland.
Right.
So we did that at Lido Beach, and we did that at Siesta Key, Siesta Key Beach. And then we came back and did a drone flyover showing those same sequences of increase in sea level, which is a video that we have out now on YouTube, and to actually help people see just what the rate of change is, to help them visualize it. And these were both done as art projects. I mean, I'm a ringling, so we're doing this stuff in design and art, because what we're trying to do is invite people to the conversation. We're not trying to tell people this is what you must do, or this is what you must be, or this is the data, that this is the only piece of data that matters. No, we want to trigger the thought process in you so that you start changing your consciousness, think about these things a little bit differently, and then come and, you know, and actually look for yourself, or do some research on your own. See what the numbers are for yourself. How do you become aware the information and learn to trust it. So we have a conversation about how can we adapt and mitigate for these changes while there is still enough time to spread the cost over a long enough period of time that it isn't some drastic, frantic hit at the very last minute.
I love the fact that you guys are thinking about it in that respect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's no point.
You were saying this is on YouTube, and that interests me. I mean, I almost went to my phone to try to pull it up because I want to see that too. Is it on a website that you guys have?
Or it is on our website, thespaceshipearth.org, and then there's also, and then again, you can also search it on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah, either way.
And just look at it as Sarasota, or how do you look at it on YouTube?
I think we just do Spaceship Earth.
Okay.
That'll take you to it, yeah.
Okay, great. So what was the next thing I was like? So not only have you done this study, but now you're also looking at greenhouse gas inventories for both the city operations and the community. Is this a lot like these new buses that we see that run on flex fuels or run on some, you know, not just flex fuels, but some of them run like, what am I trying to say? You know, electric?
Electric. So the city has been doing those inventories, and so has the county.
Mm-hmm.
Because the real question is, you know, what is our footprint?
Right.
What is our greenhouse, you know, gas release? We don't know. None of us know how to change the outcomes unless we actually have some understanding of what it is that we're actually doing.
Exactly.
And so part of this is just, you know, deciding to be honest with ourselves and say, okay, here is what we are doing, and these are the results of what we're doing. And as an ethicist, my question is always, are the results what you really wanted to have happen? You know, is that what you were trying to accomplish, or are you really trying to do something else?
Right.
And do those results match what you believe is the right thing to do? And so part of it is we just have to start with what is the actual, you know, information that is available to us, and then see how we can, in the case of greenhouse gases for the most part, how can we reduce those? And then how fast can we reduce them? And how can we encourage other people to do, you know, the reduction?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're looking at, yes.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if you can even speak to this, but I wonder a lot about, for example, these electric cars. And downtown in St. Petersburg, I see a lot of those charging stations, those vehicles charging stations. Aren't we kind of trading gas for electric? I mean, they're both consuming energy. Why is it consuming less gas is any better than consuming less electricity in these cars or the buses?
Right. The fuel, the energy that we're using is more efficient.
Good.
So, and thus we're making more effective use of the energy.
Good.
We are still, of course, at the moment, because we're using electricity in many places, we're burning fuels that do release greenhouse gases.
Right.
But they're producing less of them than we would if we were doing the cars.
Because I think I've thought about this several times. I mean, when talking about PSTA, you know, doing the flex fuel buses, and now we're like I say, we see it all the time. And I'm wondering, well, you know, aren't we just polluting only at a different level? I'm glad to hear you explain this and say that it's at a lesser level.
It is at a lesser level.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending upon the types of vehicles and the charging stations. For example, we have just scratched the surface of this conversation at Ringling, where I'm teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Our students and faculty, you know, we show up in the morning, we're doing the classes, the cars are parked for, you know, hours at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could probably recharge those cars off of solar.
Yeah.
Because the cars are parked for such an extended period of time.
That makes perfect sense.
That we can do a slower charge rate, and therefore we can use a different kind of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are also buses. More of these are in Europe at the moment. But on car commercials, people talk about, you know, what is the range of the car if it has battery? Well, what they do with some of the buses in Europe is they arrange to have charging stations at any of the longer stops that they make in their commutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the idea is, I actually don't have to charge the full battery. I just have to make sure I have more than enough charge to get to my next charging station.
I see.
And so I don't have to take a bus out of line for mm-hmm. any really noticeable period of time.
I see.
And, you know, just in the few minutes it takes a group of people to walk on and off the bus,
mm-hmm.
just have to give it sufficient charge to move it, you know, down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the plan I'm going to use, then the battery size I'm using goes down. So the weight of the vehicle goes down. So again, I'm using more of it to move the actual people as opposed to the weight of the vehicle. And so there's just a whole series of ways in which we can look at how we reconceptualize the effective modes of transportation.
Do you think that one of the reasons why you've been so successful with this is because you are partnering with an educational facility like Ringling?
Absolutely. When I was first hired back in 91 to start the environmental studies program at Ringling,
mm-hmm.
my initial approach was looking at what is it, how do I get my students to do less harm?
Oh.
So that from a design point of view, when you specified certain materials to be used, did you have a really good understanding of what it meant, of what that chain of events was,
mm-hmm.
to go from you saying, I want this to be used, to that product actually being generated, being used.
Right. It's great to talk about it. How do you put it into fruition?
Right. Now we've evolved to the point of, how do you do the good? How do you redesign communities to find the missing pieces to make their systems work more efficiently and more effectively?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, whether design is very much at the center of how do we actually reach sustainability, because it really is about reconfiguring and reconceptualizing what are the things we do, why have we been doing them this way, what is the sort of easier alternative to making the behavioral change, and the same with the art. We are living in a world at the moment where, for many people, facts don't matter or don't hold as much weight as belief.
As an educator, that must make you go through the roof. Holy cow. I know it bugs me. Oh, my gosh.
I do have my moments.
I bet you do. That must be your biggest stress level right now.
Yeah.
That's funny, Tim.
But from an art perspective, people are very open to sort of rethinking things. And mm-hmm. so there are times when having scientific information to back up what we're saying
right.
is important. But frequently, as with the Rise and Run project, you know, doing an art installation and letting people see it and talking about it as an art installation, so, you know, nobody is in any kind of immediate posture about the conversation.
Right.
Really leaves a lot of people open to have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, all we then ask is for them to, you know, think about it a little bit more and see what they want to do.
Interesting you'd say this, because on the Discovery Channel or National Geographic, several years before what happened in New Orleans happened, they had done an art rendering of what would happen if there was a very bad hurricane that, you know, hit that area just like it did. And I was so shocked at what would happen to the city when I looked at this art thing that it really made me think about it. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough time between showing that, probably, as you say, and not enough people took it to heart to do anything about it. But man, they were dead on what ended up happening.
I know. I mean, and so it is that, you know, art at times can be that opening space or that
yeah.
neutral space to see the idea in a new way,
mm-hmm.
And let you as the individual, as the viewer, respond to yourself, actually, about, you know, what it is that's happening.
Right.
Frequently what David and I will talk about with some of the numbers that we work with and the conversations we have is that, what are your assumptions about this topic?
Right.
And how well do your assumptions actually match what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And that can be very surprising for people. I mean, we have conversations, again, back to the class. You know, what is it that, you know, cows, you know, eat? You know, or where do cows live?
Mm-hmm.
and you know, old McDonald's, you know, farms, mm-hmm. you know, starts popping up in everybody's mind in the right. picture books of the happy farm. And you know, that's not the way most cattle
no.
Ends up on our plate and gets served. And so breaking that, you know, that plane of, oh, here's my, you know, preconception of, you know, mm-hmm. you know, happy cows out on the field to, oh, I see that's not actually what happens.
Right.
You know, is the way to sort of get people to rethink some of the issues.
And yeah. It matters to people, obviously, because you see a particular company has been doing the Happy Cow ad campaign
right.
to make us feel better about consuming right. those products.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah,
right. Here we are in the middle of the Sunshine State, and it has always kind of made me wonder why we aren't using solar power more effectively. And you really said something that made perfect sense to me that I've thought about for a long time. A, you said we need to be honest with ourselves. And B, we need to look at how the money that we spend today will affect us in the future, and that we say, okay, this costs too much money to put in a solar installation. How much, you're doing that, how much will it cost us if we don't?
Right. And that the only reason we're having the conversations about sea-level rise is because we currently are not taking advantage of the other energy systems.
Right.
The University of Texas in Austin, about a week ago, released a report in which they looked at what they refer to as full-cost energy, full-cost electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is the full cost in terms of the infrastructure, the environmental issues, mm-hmm. the social issues, the fuel issues to deliver fuel from and energy from a power plant to a dwelling?
And are they also looking at what it costs us as far as foreign issues?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
It's a very comprehensive
cool.
plan. And so what they found, especially looking at development in the West, was that the only thing that made actual financial sense is wind and solar.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at different ways of being able to distribute sourcing that energy, Lawrence Livermore Labs does calculations every year about the efficiency of our electric grid. And a couple of years ago, the staggering number was about 58% of the energy that we generate at all different types of power plants we use is basically lost in the transmission of getting it to mm-hmm. The building. That's a huge loss. And if you start thinking about the fact we need more energy,
right?
No, in many ways, we need to have a more effective and efficient
right.
delivery system.
Exactly.
And that's a very different conversation than where we normally get trapped of it's coal, it's oil, it's natural gas, or it's solar and wind. You know, been focused too much on trying to come up with the right answer to the wrong question. Now what we're really trying to do is make sure we get the question right and then figure out how to answer it.
It's funny you'd say that. I actually had a college teacher, and his whole idea to do the final exam was to give you questions he could ask you on the test, and then you were
right.
supposed to find the answer study. Well, which is a great idea, except that I studied the wrong answers.
Right.
So I have,
right.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he even said to me after the test, you did a great job at studying. You just studied the wrong answers. And
right.
honestly, it was a great learning experience for me because just what you said, if you aren't looking in the right place for the answers, you'll never find them.
Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I want to talk about one more thing. You're piloting an innovative thing called a living seawall. I can only imagine what that's about.
Okay. What the city of Sarasota is doing, and I'm part of a group that's also involved with this, is we're trying to ensure that we are creating habitats for, you know, juvenile fish and adult fish, and you know, have good breeding places for the fish, and to restore some of the habitat that's been disturbed, and also knock down some of the wave energy that is associated with mm-hmm. seawalls.
Right.
And so the idea here is to figure out what kind of vegetation we can grow either on a seawall or in front of a seawall so that for homeowners in the interim, their property is still, you know, protected as they like to see it protected with that
right.
wall, but the actual environmental impact is greatly reduced because the bare seawall itself has a huge environmental negative to it.
I bet.
And as soon as there is some vegetation in the area, we see that there's much more attraction of fish in the region. There are a couple mm-hmm. of scientists at MOHU who have put tags on fish in the area, and then they have sensors along several of the creeks here in Sarasota. And as the fish go by, then they get counted, and everyone is identified, and so you know which fish it is, and you mm-hmm. know which gender, and all these other kinds of things. And what they're finding is that if you've got vegetated areas, then you have more fish activity, and it looks like you're going to have more survivability of those fish. But it's really about how do I keep, again, a beautiful visual. Personally, I don't find seawalls all that attractive.
No.
I understand their purpose and their limitations. And so, is there a way to sort of vegetate around those things to, again, keep habitat in for, mm-hmm. Nesting birds, for the shellfish, for the fish themselves? And almost
artificial reef idea.
It is. And it's also sort of based on the living wall concept. There's a lot of communities, again, Europe is way ahead of us on this, that are doing living walls on the outside of their buildings as well as living roofs because it absorbs carbon dioxide.
Great idea.
The air.
Yeah.
It pulls the particulate matter out. It lowers and in some cases, you actually break up the heat island effect.
Mm-hmm.
It serves as a way to reduce stormwater flow, reduce street flooding. And in some cases, they're growing food. There are rooftop farms in New York and in Washington, D.C. This is named two cities that are doing that. There are schools that are doing this. And so as students go into the lunchroom, if they want a salad, they can actually pick it off the wall.
Wow, what a great idea.
So it just restore the whole relationship with nature for people who are in very urbanized environments and see the benefit.
I would love to talk to you for another half an hour about some of these things that we've talked about this morning. Will you promise to come back?
Sure, be happy to.
So all the things that we have talked about, we can get some more information on spaceshipearth.org, correct?
Correct. Spaceshipearth.org, yeah.
You have been an interesting guest this morning, Tim Rummage. He's
head
of the environmental studies at Ringling College, and I love this, a noted planetary ethicist. I love that. Never heard it called that before, but I think it's exactly the perfect label for you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Please come back for sure. I'm just really proud of the city of Sarasota and the communities around that, and they're just committed to this.
They are.
Environment.
And we're proud of them too.